Tuesday the 20th of March, Yudches Adar Sheni, Rabbi Svi Belovsky, Drush and Agado.
Okay, good morning. I want to talk to you about something a little unusual. I discussed with the organisers the possibility of perhaps speaking about something which is a little off track, something to get you thinking a few days after Purim. Perhaps thinking is not quite the order of the day. Now, I want to speak to you about a particular style in the writings of the Izhbitza. Now, the Izhbitza was a very controversial early 19th century thinker. For those who are not familiar with him, I'll give you a few minutes background. The Izhbitza of Motzchi Yosef Lena was a Talmud of Simcha Bonim of Shischa, and then a kind of Talmud Chover of the Kotzka, who was really the successor of Rav Simcha Bonim. He, until the late 1830s, until 1839, he lived in Kotsk and was really kind of part of the enterprise of the Kotsk Rebbe. In 1839, an event occurred that is famous in the annals of Hasidic history. No one really knows what happened, but something occurred, something strange happened, and after 1839, the Kotzke effectively became a recluse for the remaining years of his life. He emerged from his room very infrequently, he sought for him infrequently. The court and everything continued as before, but almost completely without his involvement. There was something that happened which the Izhbitza didn't like. At this stage he's not yet the Izhbitza, and then he went off to Izhbitz, which is maybe 150 miles or so south of Kotsk. This is on the east side of Warsaw. And he set up his own show, eventually in a place called Izhbitz, and he gathered a very large following. And he considered himself really to be the authentic heir to the thinking of Rav Simcha Bonim. You know, this is what happens. The Rebbe has an idea, the Talmud changes his mind, and the Talmud goes back to the original idea, it goes backwards and forwards like this. The Izhbitza held court there, and died quite young, in his 50s, in 1854. His writings were so controversial that he couldn't find a publisher for them. To the extent that his grandson, Rav Gershon Henoch Lena, who was more well known, he's the Pecheles man, the man who later on went to Rav Zin, became the Rebbe of Rav Zin, and then decided to conduct an investigation which led him to be the first person to try to renew the mitzvah of Techeles. Anyway, the grandson attempted to publish his work. He could not find a Jewish publisher for his grandfather's writings. And eventually, in 1860, he found a Gentile in Vienna who was willing to publish them, and the first edition of the Me'ah Shelach was published. It's been republished by Jewish publishers many times since. And then around 50 years later, a second volume of bits and pieces collected from other things were published as well. And it's since become a classic, albeit a controversial classic of Hasidic writings. What did he say that was so contentious? What sort of things did he say? I mean, his writings are fairly brief. There's only two volumes, although there are his Talmud, Reb Leib Eiger, who was the grandson of Rabbi Akiva Eiger, whose family was so incensed that he became Hasidish, he became a follower of the Izhbitza, that the parents sat shiva for him when he became a Chosid. It's just that one has to learn these things which were not necessarily all that popular these days. Anyway, Reb Leib Eiger became the Rebbe in Lublin, and then following his death with Tzadok HaKohen, who is much more well known, the most well known probably of all these figures, Tzadok HaKohen Rabinovitz of Lublin, who was the other main Talmud of the Izhbitza, then became the Rebbe in Lublin, and that takes us to about 1900 when Reb Tzadok was Nifta. Now, the Izhbitza had a very curious approach to life. There are two things which I'll tell you, and then we're going to study some of his ideas, and I'll tell you why it's of interest to me. The first thing which made him unpopular, it was that he was an antinomian. Now, antinomianism is a word that is normally associated with Christian thought. However, it does have its Jewish version. What is antinomianism? It's a kind of anti-halachic approach, meaning that the Ishbitzer saw the entire halakhic system as a means rather than an end. He saw it as a way in which a person would develop a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to the extent that he now had his own relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and no longer needed the halakha. That's antinomianism. That the objective of a religious life is to be freed from the rules rather than to be bound by them. That's a pretty controversial way of looking at things. Now, in practice, it's worthwhile mentioning the Ishbitzer was extremely frum. There is no suggestion whatsoever that he regarded these ideas as anything other than theoretical. An aspirational objective of perfect human beings, which he did not consider himself, he is understood to have led an extremely ascetic and extremely pious life. And this should never be considered as a suggestion that he did anything other than that. But nonetheless, in principle, he understood that the central idea that Matan Torah was a universal revelation of, if you like, of practice, and halakhic imperative for every individual, he rejected that. He understood that Matan Torah was a tool, and that if a person was sufficiently successful in developing their religious life, they would then be given new instructions, if you like, from God. He would have a relationship with God, might tell him he has to keep Shabbos on a Tuesday, or not keep Shabbos at all and do something different, because that's what he demands, the central tenet of a universal and, if you like, across the board revelation applying to every person. That was not part of the Ishbitzer thinking. That's point one. The second point was that he was a determinist, meaning that he did not really believe in Bechira Chofshis in the traditional sense. They say about the Ishbitzer, Hakol bidei shamayim, afilu yirah shamayim. Right? In an adjustment of the Chazal. And in fact, the Ishbitzer's biographer, Feierstein, calls his biography All Is in the Hands of Heaven, which is a reasonable name, a reasonable title for someone. And this, of course, made him rather unpopular as well, because we understand that free will, Bechira Chofshis, is a central tenet of Jewish life. It brings life meaning, but our decisions are imbued with meaning as a result of Bechira Chofshis. He understands that life appears to have free will, but in fact that is also an illusion, and everything is actually determined. There's a story about the Ishbitzer, and then we'll move on to actually study something. There's a story about the Ishbitzer, when they say that, we mentioned already that his writings were unpopular, and even when they were published, there were people who were extremely opposed to their distribution. Gershon Hendrick in 1860, when the book was published, there were little sort of Ishbitzer study circles in various kind of shteklach in Poland, and I don't suppose the book was easily available for sale, but they distributed some places. So there was a particular place, I don't know the name of the village, somewhere in Poland, where every Thursday night a group of people would get together, and then they stood in the shiva, they would study the writings of the Ishbitzer. And this happens in my house as well, by the way, but that's another story, right? Now, every Thursday night they would arrive and they would discover that the sefer was missing. The sefer was missing. They didn't have several copies. They had one copy and the copy was missing. And they would look, and after a while they knew where it was going to be. These days, in those times, they didn't have inside toilets. They had outside privies, the outhouse, and they would find the book there, which would cause them great offence. They would bring it back in. And in 1 week they decide they have enough of this. They're going to wait and see what's happening. So they get there an hour early, and they discover a chosid of another variety, surreptitiously taking the book and sitting in the outhouse and reading it. They were extremely distressed by this. They grab hold of the guy and they're about to probably kick the hell out of him. At which point he says to them, "Hold on a minute, are you not Talmidim of the Ishbitzer?" They said, "Yes." "But is it true that the Ishbitzer was a determinist?" They said, "That's true." "And that means presumably that I couldn't control this action when I took the sefer and took it to the outhouse. This was predetermined and therefore beyond my control." They said, "Yes, I suppose we would have to admit that." He said, "In that case, leave me alone." And apparently they did. Anyway, so that gives you some idea of how, the way the Ishbitzer thought. Now, the reason why these ideas I'm going to share with you are significant is because one of the things that I'm engaged in, a certain type of outreach, trying to demonstrate the beauty and cogency and MS of authentic Yiddishkeit to people who are not yet fully involved and engaged with it. So, And one of the things we have a tendency to do when people ask questions, they are difficult questions, questions which are really important existential questions. For example, Sadiq Zarawi, can you explain to me why terrible things happen to good people? One of some of the classic difficulties, can you explain, you know, we can list many of them, but perhaps Sadiq Zarawi is at the top of the list. We have a tendency to respond to these sorts of questions by saying, well, actually, there is a Jewish answer. Let me show you tell you what the answer is. Now, I'm not telling there isn't a Jewish answer. There, of course, every significant Jewish philosopher or theologian, as every significant non-Jewish theologian, has attempted to address these sorts of questions, and there are Jewish answers, if you like, to questions like Sadiq Zarawi. But very often, that isn't necessarily the right approach. What very often is we're frightened of validating doubt or complexity. Sometimes what a person needs is not some trite, simplistic answer. And sort of, you put the whole thing in a kind of context, you can get someone who's has a very advanced understanding of philosophy and theology, is completely au fait with a wide range of medieval approaches to theodicy, which is the actual correct theological word for the study and attempt to understand why bad things happen to good people. Theodicy. And they know all the medieval writings, and they know all the modern philosophers, and they approach the rabbi who is trying to macabre them and said, I'm very troubled by this issue. Could you give me an answer? Well, how does Judaism approach this? And this person takes an outreach manual, doesn't know very much about the subject, flips through it, and he goes, oh, here's the answer. And he gives some trite, you know, six-sentence answer. So what is perhaps the most complex issue that has beset philosophers and thinkers throughout history? This is not Kirov Rechokim. This is Rechok Krovim. Right? This is a Rechok rather than a Kirov exercise. Because we are often frightened to validate another person's doubts or uncertainties because we're frightened to expose that we may have them ourselves. The Ishvitzer will teach us that's not necessarily the only approach. Now, the Ishvitzer has a range of writings on the theme of doubt. Some of them I think I may have touched on before, but this is an opportunity if we had to discuss them again. Now, the Ishvitzer in Parshas Vayera has an approach to the Akedah. Now, when he writes about the Akedah, he has two pieces, one in the first volume, one in the second volume. This is the one in the first volume. And he explains, he has a radical rereading of many biblical narratives. What made him most unpopular, by the way, was precisely this. That as a result of being a kind of determinist, seeing that everything was the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted, it was really foreordained in some way. And as a result of being an antinomian, which we've discussed already, he also felt it necessary to radically reread some of the classic stories. And he says things about some of the biblical figures, which one can understand will take a deep breath to be able to cope with. For example, in the story, the most famous one, this was cut out of some editions, the most famous one, in the narrative of Pinchas and Zimri, he says it's obvious to him that Zimri is the hero and Pinchas is a failure. That is not, obviously, the classic way of teaching. This is not how my children are taught this story in school, if indeed they're taught in school at all. Right? And he's well known for this. This is the most radical story. He says that Noah got it right in the vineyard, Korach was a good guy, he's got like, and so on and so forth. Right? And this requires significantly, as I said, you need to take a deep breath. And you can also understand why this raised people very angry. In a similar way, he radically reads the story of the Akedah. And he understands that the Akedah was a challenge of Emunah. Now, okay, that's not news, but he casts it in a particular way. He says that there is, if you like, a contradiction. There's a contradiction in the instruction that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives him. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, Es brisi okimes Yitzchok. He also says, your children, my descendants, Avram says, are going to come through Yitzchok. Yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, Vaha'alehu l'oilo, bring him up as an offering. Now, of course, you can touch it in different ways. Alehu l'oilo means, as Rashi says, I told you to bring him up, now bring him down, I never told you to kill him. But it was entirely reasonable that Avram should understand that instruction to mean kill him. In fact, he clearly did understand to kill him, because he attempted to kill him, and at the last second was stopped. So, it's living with the complexity that the Yuzhbitsa says is the challenge that Avram is required to pass. Avram is required to be able to, as it were, as they would say in another place, not in the type of English I generally use, to hold by the Sophic. Right? He had to hold by the Sophic, meaning it was incomprehensible. Avram was required to recognize that in the realm of the divine, there is an element of incomprehensibility. You can't understand what happens. He is required not to vote for one or the other. One is to say, look, he can't be, God's changed his mind, he doesn't want Yitzchak to be the father of my children anymore. To abandon that and now to kill him. That's the wrong approach. He's also not required to say, God doesn't want me to kill him, really. And actually what will happen is, ki v'yitzchak yichoreh l'kol zorah. Doesn't want to say that either. Kodesh Baruch Hu demands of Avram that he goes ahead, continues through the process, without resolving the problem, aware that there may be a degree of complexity or unknown that he will simply not be able to resolve, and from either accept the possibility that both can simultaneously exist, at least by Kodesh Baruch Hu. The two things can't close as fast because we live in a world of physical limitation. And killing someone who has no children and him being the father of your grandchildren is impossible. But it's not impossible in the realm of the divine. That is his understanding of the occasion. Avram is required to be able to simultaneously deal with that and to be able to live a life. To be able to maintain a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, despite the fact there are raging doubts, uncertainties that are unresolvable. It's a very interesting reading of the story. I find this reading very appealing. Obviously not the only one, and there are many. For those who are interested in these sorts of things, then I recommend Gelman. Yehuda Gelman is in Haranoff has written two books on the unusual Hasidic approaches to the Akedah. It's a kind of foil to Kierkegaard, but that's for another time. Now, okay, so that's the beginning of his idea, that it's possible to validate doubt or complexity without losing sight of one's relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Avram is not expected to be paralyzed by this doubt. He's not expected to go into some kind of depression or inaction. He's required to maintain his enthusiasm, his vision. See, Vash came up on Baboiker. That's what the story is telling us, according to the Ishbitzer. He's capable of maintaining the inspiration, despite the fact there are unknowns and uncertainties. Religious life, says the Ishbitzer, does not have to be simplified. It does not have to be devoid or removed of its complexity. It does not have to pretend there are no doubts or uncertainties. This is brought out further in Parshas Vayeshev, where Yaakov be'eretz mugurei oviv. Okay, Yaakov is settled. What is that, being settled? So, this is the Medrash which I quote frequently to my children. Bikesh Yaakov le'shev bashal. The kids say, I hit the kids, what are you doing? They're going to do nothing. What do we do? Nothing. We don't do nothing. Yaakov appears to want to, well, superficial reading of the Medrash is, but Yaakov is being read as, he feels, you know, I've done my bit, all these trials and tribulations, I've produced my family, the time has come for someone else to be the centre of the story. I'd like to put my feet up, you know, I'd like to learn a toast verse, and I'd like just to Just like to live out happy old age without challenges, right? I'm fed up. Because Yaakov v'Shevashav, he wants to live a tranquil, peaceful life. I want life to be, to be straightforward. And Kodesh Baruch Hu answers, Rashi quotes this, that no, there's plenty of time in Olam MS to do nothing. That's not for now. This is the time of that. Right? So, say to the children, you know, that Olam Hazeh is not a time for doing nothing. You certainly didn't learn doing nothing from your parents. We don't do nothing. Sometimes there's productive rest or relaxation, but doing nothing, that resting is always with a view to being able to do what you do properly, to learn and to work and to give tzedakah with more energy. It's not an end in itself. That's the standard understanding. Bikesh Yaakov le'shev bashalva. Ishbitzer doesn't like that reason, because it's just not possible. It's just not possible that that's what Yaakov Avinu wants. That he wants just to put his feet up on the porch and do some knitting and sit in his rocking chair. You know, he's not interested in that. He knows that's not what you do, and it's not what he asks. he gives his new reading. His new reading is that Yaakov has lived a life where he has been beset by doubts, with problems, and he wants, as he puts, to be mistalik mikol sofek lishmoy mikol maisira osu b'shalvo. That's the loss of the Ishbitza. He wants to be able to live his life removed or devoid of any doubts. I want certainty. I want to be protected from any bad occurrences. That's the shalva. That's the tranquility. B'chesh Yaakov l'shei b'shalva. That's the tranquility that Yaakov requests, as it were, through this medrash and that Chazal see in the word Vayeshev. So he goes on and explains, that is not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants. HaKadosh Baruch Hu cannot supply a world where there are no doubts, where there are no problems with one's relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And for, I say myself, to add to this, that the Pasuk says in Parshas Vayishlach, defining the name Yisrael, Ki soriso im Elokim v'im anoshim v'atuchal. You're called Yisrael, your key identity, because you have struggled with man and with God and prevailed. What's with God? That part of the identity of a Jew, a real spiritual life, is not about simplification, pretending there are no difficulties or problems. It's living in a meaningful, inspirational life in connection with God, despite that. Ki soriso im Elokim v'atuchal. So he says, and here the Ishbitzer says, that although Omolo Hashem Yisborach, God says to him in response to Yaakov, in response to his request to live in tranquility, ki ba'oida odem baguf, while a person is still yet alive in this world, ein be'efsha lisnai b'kol kach shmir v'yira v'anova. It is not possible for a person to live in this kind of, if you like, in this kind of hermetically sealed place, which is devoid of doubt, devoid of problems, devoid of sorrows. That's just not what life is about. You can't live in this kind of bubble of yira and anova. Human beings are required to engage in the world, and in the imperfect world there are doubts and complexities, and your request to live in an uncomplex world with no doubts is unacceptable. He says, and he quotes a pasuk, V'shav Yaakov v'shokat v'shanam v'ei machrid. He said, V'shav Yaakov, Yaakov will dwell, v'shokat, and things will be quiet, the Shanam, and there'll be no problems, they mark, there'll be nothing to be afraid. He says, for Shov, it's Loshen Osid. It's a future tense. That posuk is referring to the Osid Lovoi. He said, that's what happens to you most on Mashiach. What Yaakov is really requesting is a life devoid of complexity, devoid of doubt, of complete certainty. That's not for now. That's what it will be like, the Osid Lovoi, you most on Mashiach. That is not how the world is supposed to be. He said, and you can see, it's Vayeshev Yaakov and Vashov Yaakov. It's much the same Loshon, the same phrase. He said, and therefore Yaakov is required to continue to live his life with doubt and complexity, because that's what real spiritual life is actually about. He also says, in Parshas told us, that the same thing, that a person is almost required. He said it's a special haftocha for the Jewish people. There isn't time to sort of talk about this in any detail. There's a haftocha, what he calls a mivtach oiz b'Hashem Yisborach. There is a certain promise for God, from God, that if a person approaches him and continues his relationship despite all the doubts, then gradually during his life he will get greater clarity. But pretending the doubts aren't there, trying to pretend there are no complexities or difficulties or unanswered questions, or anguished existential issues that keep us awake at night, he said, not only is that not how it's supposed to be, but in fact, if you are living like that, you probably deceived yourself, and by not acknowledging that in others, you're probably deceiving them inadvertently as well. You can see from my perspective why these ideas, they're controversial. They're certainly managing to keep you awake this morning. They're controversial, but they're also immensely valuable in terms of our interactions with those who come to us with issues. And you know what we say, our children, they say, why does such a terrible disaster happen? Why does this problem happen? Can you explain this kind of hashkafic complexity? And we all have a tendency to try to avoid difficulty. We all want, everyone likes things to be simple, straightforward, to push away difficulties. this is not necessarily the right approach. Eisbitzer shows us that not only is that not necessary for a full and meaningful religious life, but it may actually be indicative of some kind of religious stasis. If a person believes that there are no complexities or difficulties, and they really think everything's got a simple answer, and they behave and live and teach like that, then you know what? It could be that they've deceived themselves into a kind of religious bubble which doesn't actually exist. And perhaps this bubble will burst at some point. He is teaching us that struggling with issues, struggling with complexities, and so on, that's real life. And there's nothing wrong with that. And the challenge of the Akedah was Avram going through this process and being capable of Vayashkem Avram Baboike. He continues with great enthusiasm. He is not deterred in his religious life or his enthusiasm by the fact that there are unanswered issues. So how does that work in terms of one's, if you like, outreach or connection with those people who are not involved in the community, or even those within the community who raise difficulties and problems? Well, the most important thing one can do is not necessarily try to answer the question, but to validate it. To acknowledge it. There's no harm in acknowledging it. Some people feel it's a weakness. You're right. Terrible things happen in the world, and I can't explain them. Some people who are involved in sort of outreach or communicating with the outside will believe that's a sign of weakness. I need to have an answer for everything. These are just teachings, so I don't have to have an answer for everything. And not only that, I can say, you know, I know that there are many approaches in classic Jewish sources, and I'm very happy to study them. I can tell you what they are. We can think about it. But you think I'm not burning with anguish and unanswered questions about this myself? That's not a sign of weakness. The Ishbitzer says that's a sign of real religious life. If you are still davening and still doing mitzvahs and still progressing and still learning, despite the fact that you have these burning and raging doubts, of course you are attempting to resolve them. That's a much bigger sign of a meaningful and purposeful religious life than sort of suggesting, well, actually, I'm not troubled when this disaster happens. And when these people have got nothing to eat, or this person is killed, I've got, you know, it's you, right, but it doesn't trouble me. What do you mean it doesn't trouble you? We can validate a person's concerns, their doubts, whether they're doubts about what happens in the world, or whether they're theological or philosophical doubts, without it in any way harming the quality or intensity of our religious life. So sometimes the right approach, and that's really the limit from this, sometimes the right approach is to say, I acknowledge, and I can experience and share it with you. We can learn some of the classic approaches to suggest that the Jewish sources have not attempted to address issues like Tzadik V'Ra'aloi would be incorrect. There are numerous approaches. I think that I saw in Rabbi Arya Kaplan's book of Jewish sources something like 40 sources in Rishonim and the Kabbalistic sources are trying to address this in different ways, and so on. So of course learning some of those is a very good idea. But learning them and knowing intellectually what some of the answers are to these sorts of questions doesn't necessarily have any impact on the way we feel or the way we acknowledge we feel. In the end, the Ishvita helps us to say that by validating the doubts and complexity of other people's religious struggle, we're going to do a lot better than trying to push it aside. Have a good day.